to KBOO Portland.
Ready for another year of grassroots community radio? With your support, it's possible. Go to kboo.fm/give or mail a check to 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214 to contribute to KBOO's $75,000 goal for our Catalog of Connections year-end campaign, going now until December 31st. What better way to celebrate than by giving your loved one a KBOO membership this season?
Be sure to tune in to Radio Lost and Found. It's the show that puts the OO in KBOO. Radio Lost and Found is a two-hour media escape of found sounds, forgotten records, outre recordings, and more. Coming to you every second and fourth Thursday from 10 to midnight, right here on KBOO.
Making contact.
You're listening to Making Contact. I'm Lucy Kang. In a dark warehouse space, dancers dressed in blue tank tops and shorts cradle small wooden beds. They move the beds around their bodies, pressing their faces into them at one point. The movements seem both intimate and melancholy. It's October 2023, and I'm watching a dance performance in San Francisco called If I Give You My Sorrows from Flyaway Productions. And the bed will show up again and again in different positions and sizes. For an hour, performers will dance with and around beds, small ones and large ones, and one that swings through the air as they twist and glide around it. But these are not just any beds. These beds are meant to evoke prison beds.
So the piece used the beds as a physical and metaphoric frame to look at the experience of women who are currently incarcerated.
This is Joe Kreider, artistic director of Flyaway Productions and the creative director of If I Give You My Sorrows.
I've been working with artists and people who are incarcerated since 2017. So with this piece, we asked the women, how is your bed an antidote to your prison experience?
Joe knows what it's like to have had an incarcerated loved one. She's created an entire series of work around the experiences of incarcerated people, including three site-specific productions in the Decarceration Trilogy. And for this show, she interviewed currently and formerly incarcerated women, sometimes for hours.
And I asked them, tell me about a bed. Tell me about your prison bed. What is a secret that only your bed knows about you? Tell me about your childhood bed. Tell me about your ideal bed. And from those questions emerged a picture of both the struggle of being in prison and the ways that women, or the women we spoke to at least, adapt.
Those words were then incorporated into some of the music composed for the performance, like this piece that includes the voice of formerly incarcerated trans activist Lisa Strawn.
This is Lisa Strawn. I'm a trans woman, and I recently was paroled after 25 years from San Quentin. I can't even begin to tell you the fear, not just myself, but everyone else had every day.
The bed is portrayed as a kind of repository for deeply private feelings and thoughts. To me, it feels like this idea of the bed challenges the ways that the prison industrial complex dehumanizes the people inside, where incarcerated human beings are often euphemistically referred to in budgets as beds. Art, though, can show the human beings inhabiting those beds. Whether through dance, visual art, or the written word, it has the power to reveal what's hidden. It can peel back the layers of censorship that are inherent to incarceration. One of the people Joe Kreider interviewed for the dance performance was Betty McKay, also known as Ms. Betty. Ms. Betty was formerly incarcerated and started off as an advocate inside prison.
I was incarcerated for 27 years. And that is a lot, particularly for women, because we are at the bottom of the totem pole for everything. I became a voice inside because we didn't have voices. And it's hard to get people to stand up to the system when you're inside because of retaliation. If you try to address an issue or you try to bring light to something, you could end up like in another prison, way away from your children, your loved ones, everything.
Joe approached Miss Betty about contributing to the dance piece.
And she was just like, Betty, I want you to tell your story and we're going to do it into dance. And I was like, what? My story? And she was like, yes, you have a story. And so I just, I showed up at the studio. They put me in a booth. They asked me a million questions. I answered as authentically as I could. It got emotional at times. Just the memories of some of the things that I went through touched me. I didn't know that I still had triggers to things from my incarceration, but I did. And a lot of that came through in the dance, and you heard me saying the words. When I heard him, I got emotional at the performance. My bed now, when I came home, my bed now is the antidote for a lot of things. I look at my room now and I be like, thank you, Lord, thank you. Rubbing my body on those satin sheets. My bed now, my bed is a confidant. Satin sheets.
Wow. I mean, I just remember when I was watching the performance, just being so struck by your words in particular. And I went back through and listened to it again before this interview. And just, you know, the words and the music and I think the emotion, you know, really, really comes through in that section. And there's a line where you say something like, my bed now, when I came home, is an antidote to a lot of things. And I'm just wondering, could you describe what you meant by that?
Oh, I don't know why. I'm just like almost crying right here, right now, thinking of that. Because what I know to be true is that the bed, it was like, I never really thought about my bed, but my bed was like the only place that I could be like totally authentic with myself. Like I could cry in my bed, because even though I was someone in the prison that everyone looked for to solve problems and to make things happen and to do different things, every day wasn't a good day for me. But I couldn't be like that outside of that bed. That bed is the only place that I could be alone with myself and my thoughts.
27 years. It was hard, very hard. 27 years. And every day, and just lie there. It was hard, very hard, very hard, very hard.
I would just like to encourage people to take the time to reimagine who who and what incarcerated people are and what they can do and what they're capable of. Because what I know to be true is that what I did to be in prison isn't who I am. It's what I did. Everyone has a story. And you don't know me unless you know my story. So you can't judge me unless you know my story.
This project made me reconsider what my bed means to me, which I hadn't thought of much before. It made me think of how the bed as an object, this piece of furniture I use every day that's made specifically for my rest, holds so much intimacy and care. But that also makes the absence of the system of care in prisons and other carceral facilities so stark in comparison.
It was hard in there. In some days, was harder than others. And some days that bed was comforting. And so it's like everything that I went through, everything that I was feeling in my heart, in my soul, could only be shared with my bed. And when I came home, once I got a job and had a little bit of money and was able to get a little bit of credit, the bed was the first thing I bought. That was the first thing I bought for myself after 27 years of incarceration, was the bed. And right now, today, that bed still means the same thing to me.
I'm just jumping in to remind you that you're listening to Making Contact. If you like today's show and want more information, or if you'd like to leave us a comment, visit us at our new website, focmedia.org. There you can access today's show and all of our prior episodes. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Making Contact. I'm Lucy Kang. Earlier on today's show, we heard about a dance performance highlighting the experience of women who are incarcerated and the complex ways they relate to their beds. In the next half of the show, we're going to look more closely at a related art exhibition and what it tells us about how people outside prison walls, including those who are formerly incarcerated, can support and uplift the voices of women inside. The question that Joe Kreider built the dance performance around was, how is your bed an antidote? And that question was also used as a prompt for a visual art and poetry exhibition called The Only Door I Can Open, featuring work from artists and writers inside Central California Women's Prison, or CCWF, in Chowchilla. The exhibition, like the dance piece, was a collaboration between Empowerment Avenue, the Museum of the African Diaspora, and Flyaway Productions. Two women currently inside that prison curated and contributed to The Only Door I Can Open. You'll hear their voices in the rest of the episode. They were recorded on calls made from inside prison, and as you'll be able to tell, the prison phones don't have the best quality. And you'll also hear how that quality changes depending on which recording we used. Here's one of the exhibition's curators, writer and poet Tamikia Johnson.
You know, we all have to process a really abstract question that some of us probably never considered, and that was, well, you know, what is our bed? A woman's bed here is much more than where she puts pajamas on, goes to sleep, wakes up. You know, it's so much more than that.
Artist and writer Chantel Jeanette Black is the other curator. She's been a painter since before she was incarcerated.
So for a lot of us, our bed was that sanctuary, which is expressed either in poetry or through visual art. And so we kind of like got to expose that suppression through how we are under constant surveillance. We're always exposed in our most vulnerable moments.
When it first launched, The Only Door I Can Open was shown in a gallery space near the dance performance venue in San Francisco. Paintings, drawings, and works with poetry hung on the walls. And what stood out to me was just how differently the artists responded to the question about their beds. One of the pieces on display was a poem Tamikia wrote called My Bunk Bed as an Antidote. This poem is where the title of the exhibition came from. Here's an excerpt recorded in her voice from within the prison.
I've been giving it some thought about how the only door I can open in prison is an invisible one leading to my bunk bed. It calls me when it wants and needs me. Sometimes it betrays my insomnia, giving me a few drips of sleep.
I want to turn now to look at what it took for Tamikia and Chantel to curate the show from inside prison. One of the first steps was finding other incarcerated artists to work with. That wasn't easy because of the restrictions placed on them by the prison. Plus, the planning process took place during COVID lockdowns. Here's Chantel.
It was very challenging within this particular institution because I believe we are currently the nation's or one of the top largest prisons within the world. And so it's very big for a women's institution specifically, not in comparison to men's. We have three separate yards, and within those three separate yards, we can't really intermix. Like, I'm not allowed on another yard.
The yards are named alphabetically. During the time that they were planning the show, Tamikia was in C as in Charlie Yard, while Chantel was in B as in Bravo Yard. When the project kicked off, they were in the same yard, but then later got moved to different ones. So they used a go-between, but not a person. It was a notebook. One of those lined composition journals I remember from school.
Tamika and I came up with a wonderful plan of a notebook that we can pass around. So when you go to education or medical or the law library or wherever we go where we know we can meet up, we can pass the notebook and say, can you get this to so-and-so? Can you get this to the next unit? And then people, it's like a prison culture to say, like, can you pass this notebook or can you pass this letter to somebody? That it's pretty common to do that. That is one tool that we use to overcome the barrier of being separated, being on quarantine, and having limited access to one another.
The notebook included a description of the project and a list of potential artists that grew as the notebook made its way around the prison.
A lot of effort to coordinate between Tamika and I to get that notebook between the yards. We would meet on main yard at the law library and be able to switch it off there and pass it around. And sometimes it was definitely during COVID, so we had to wait a few weeks at times.
Chantel explains their strategy through a phone call. Halfway through, you'll hear an automated voice break in. It's just one reminder of the many limitations on communications inside prisons.
So because of the COVID quarantines and the limited networking and person skills, we had to do a little more of by word. So, you know, by word of mouth, so through the grapevine, like, do you know any...
This call and your telephone number will be monitored and recorded.
And we kind of had to trust on reputation.
Then, once the artists were selected, Chantel and Tamikia worked with them to produce their pieces. Here's Tamikia again.
I offered them art supplies. I helped them write their biographies, artist statements, art descriptions, and I broke down the value of their pieces, teaching them how to evaluate them.
Prisons, jails, and detention centers are built on the logic of confinement, of surveillance, and of erasure from public life. And that means the voices of people who are incarcerated are routinely censored, even though they are the only ones who can really speak to the human impacts of incarceration. Chantel also made work for the show. One really stood out to me. Letter to My Bed features a poem painted onto a bedsheet with images of a tree, moon, and sun.
And I actually wrote the letter on an actual sheet. It is a PIA, and that's Prison Industry Authority sheet that we are all issued when we come into the prison. We each get two sheets, a pillowcase, and the basics.
The California Prison Industry Authority sheets are made by incarcerated people and distributed inside prisons for them to use.
And in the prison, in this particular prison. They put 8 women in one room, which is about 18 by 18 square feet. So it's not a lot of space. Your bunk space is really where we live, cook, do our homework, our study time, our meditations, our reflection. And with 8 other people in the room, the only way you can feel like you're alone is by hanging up a sheet, either clipping it up or tying a shoelace from one end of the bunk post to the other end and hang your sheet over it. So I wrote a letter thanking the sheet for the privacy and the solitude that it gives me with the illusion of separating myself in my own little space from everyone else.
Chantel then painted the words and images onto the sheet with a paintbrush, working with a paperclip for the finest lines. She then used a hairdryer to heat set the paint so the sheet could be washed. Here's an excerpt from that poem in her own voice.
I am utmost grateful for the illusion of privacy that you provide when I hang my sheet across your line. You have been my only resource for healing the abundance of scars within and without. It is only here where I can close my eyes and be the mother I was meant to be, where I can hold her again, laugh and play with my family. I can release all the tears felt from grief through the years. Time has no meaning other than knowing the world outside continues without me.
As curators of The Only Door I Can Open, Chantel and Tamikia were supported by the organization Empowerment Avenue. I first heard about Empowerment Avenue through their projects to help writers who are incarcerated get their work published. The organization's executive director is Rahsaan New York Thomas. You might have heard him as a host on the award-winning podcast, Ear Hustle.
This program got started because I needed it. I was in prison and I was writing about what I was witnessing. I became a person who was working for the newsroom, writing articles for San Quentin News. I became a co-host of Ear Hustle, and I also got involved in making documentary films, but I needed more. I felt like the economic piece was missing, and I felt like at a certain point, I was just preaching to the same people, preaching to the choir, and so I longed to get my voice past the choir into bigger ponds and to like get economically compensated for it, and at the same time, I was watching the artists around me give their art away to nonprofits. So economic empowerment was critical. And so Empowerment Avenue started as a concept that I saw was necessary because as a writer, I only got 8 stories published in 7 years and only made $400 on my own. But meanwhile, there was a guy I was incarcerated with. He had made a connection with an editor at a magazine who not only hired him to be a columnist, but acted as a person who would help him pitch his stories to other organizations. And he was getting published left and right. And I was like, man, not only do I need somebody like that, everybody needs somebody like that if you're a writer and you're incarcerated.
Editors who are willing to work with writers inside prisons provide really crucial access to platforms that are otherwise denied to them. And Empowerment Avenue tries to facilitate relationships that get incarcerated artists and writers published and paid. Rahsaan was an interesting person to talk to for this story because he's also worked as an art curator. That's during his time inside San Quentin.
First of all, I start out like not knowing how to curate anything, but just knowing that certain artwork was beautiful to me and wanting to share that artwork, what I saw with the world.
So Rahsaan knows firsthand about the challenges that Chantel and Tamikia went through, and just like them, he had to learn how to manage time. Things sometimes take longer in prison, like longer than you think, especially during the height of COVID lockdowns.
I kind of plan for it. Like, I know that prison's going lockdown, so I can't wait till the last minute. You have to work ahead of time and not behind and make it happen. I think the most interesting part for me is as a curator for the first time, I'm asking people to give me their artwork in January, in December, in November for a show that basically almost a year away, 9-10 months away. And so they have to trust my vision, right? They have to believe in me. And so having those relationships with all these guys in place was really key. And I'm honored that they did trust me. They all gave me their artwork. Then everybody in that exhibit made $600 off the top. And so I'm really proud of that. that we were able to do that and set a new trend. Like normally when you're in a museum, all you get is exposure. This time we got the guys paid.
Rahsaan took what he had learned and wrote a guide to share with Chantel and Tamikia as they prepared to curate The Only Door I Can Open. It was just one way that he and his colleague, Christine Lashaw, Director of Visual Arts for Liberation, supported them.
From start to finish, it was a lot of teamwork, a lot of communication, a lot of letter writing, and a lot of phone calls. This is the first exhibit I have ever curated or co-curated. Honestly, this project, this whole exhibit would not be possible without the collaborative teamwork and open line of communication that Tamika and I both had with Empowerment Avenue. And I always felt like I was included, like my voice was being heard. And we moved into the actual production days. They did a video visit with me where I could see the actual art space, the museum space. I got videograms of the dance production. Like, it was so thorough and so professional. It exceeded all my expectations.
For Rahsaan, it was especially important to uplift the voices of incarcerated women. Incarceration impacts the over 190,000 women and girls currently held in prisons, jails, and correctional and detention centers in the United States differently than it does men.
I feel like women are not given the honor and respect that they deserve in this world in general, and incarcerated women, forget about it. For example, the men's prison has access to all this art supplies and a thriving art program, and the women's prison did not have that. And they're the fastest growing prison population. And Chowchilla is one of the, if not the biggest, women's facility in the country, if not the world. And so we need to shine some light on how things are done there and what needs to be improved.
In fact, the Prison Policy Initiative says that, quote, women in prison are worse off than men, both leading up to and during their incarceration. And that's troubling because the number of women being incarcerated is rising at double the rate of men. And the thing is, we don't really know why that is, because the data is inconsistent or incomplete. And gender-based violence definitely plays a role. Women are often incarcerated for fighting back against their abusers. Incarcerated women are three times as likely as men to be sexually abused by prison or jail staff. And that's for women across the board, without slicing it down even further into women of color and queer and trans women. Prisons and other carceral institutions are dehumanizing, but art can push against that. It can remind us of the brutality, punishment, and control inherent to prisons, and instead help us imagine communities that are built on care. Care that acknowledges our humanity, like healthcare for everyone, and education and housing, and having a bed that's not in a cage. Here's Chantel.
So the thing that's really important that I hope people get out of this exhibit is to see the humanity and individuality of women incarcerated. Having that artistic platform to speak up and be heard, that is invaluable to me. It's just so precious and important for each one of us to be able to speak up and be heard and seen as the mothers, daughters, sisters that we are, not what the media portrays people incarcerated to be.
The Only Door I Can Open and If I Give You My Sorrows are collaborations between Flyaway Productions, Empowerment Avenue, and the Museum of the African Diaspora. You can catch The Only Door I Can Open starting February 1st and If I Give You My Sorrows starting January 31st at Yerba Buena Center for the Arts in San Francisco. The music you heard in this episode was composed for If I Give You My Sorrows, and the album is available for purchase online. We'll have links to all those and more at focmedia.org. Big thanks to Christine Lashaw from Empowerment Avenue for recording interviews with Chantel and Tamikia. And that does it for today's show. I'm Lucy Kang. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.
Are you a fan of early rock and roll, doo-wop, rhythm and blues, and 70s rock? If so, The Roots of Rock and Roll is the show for you, and KBOO Portland is the place to be Friday afternoons at 3. Dale Farr will give you a history lesson from the birth of rock and roll through the 50s and 60s. And Ray Bodwell will mine the 60s and 70s for the deep cuts, hidden gems, and variety that you won't hear on generic classic rock stations. So tune in to The Roots of Rock and Roll, Fridays at 3 p.m. on KBOO Portland, your community radio station.
Welcome to Boom Goddess Radio. I am Jennifer Davis Page, your host. Today, we're going to talk about smartphones. As I talk to so many of my listeners, a lot of them argue all the time about which phone is best, Apple, Pixel, Samsung, and everybody thinks that the phone that they have is the very best phone. Well, I have a guest with me today, Stephen Somerville, who's the president of Infinite Broadcasting, who's going to help us sort through all of this information. Stephen, welcome to Boom Goddess Radio.
Hello, hello. Appreciate you having me on the show.
Let's start from the beginning. Let's start with the ABCs of smartphones. There is no manual. When I got my Apple phone years, I've been an Apple person for years and years. There's no guide when you get it. So you just have to learn how to use it. And that's a task in and of itself. Tell our listeners, what exactly is a smartphone?
In the best words I can say, actually Steve Jobs said this, it's a utility, right? Because, I mean, think about it, you know, at least 20 years ago, 30 years ago, you know, we had clocks, you know, we had other various devices. And then once these smartphones came out, then it was, you know, if I need a reminder, I can do it on my phone. So a smartphone is essentially a utility that you can use and carry with you anywhere you need to go.
What is the best way to use your smartphone? I mean, I have an Apple phone and I still don't know all the things that I can do with it. You know, I stumble on some things and you Google and you get that kind of information. But what's the best way to use your smartphone?
I would say it just depends on what you're trying to do or what industry you're in. You know, of course, like, if you're in the business industry, for example, or like how, like myself, you know, I actually have two Android phones, well, three Android phones, one's for my daughter. But with my two business phones, you know, I use it to set up meetings or to make phone calls, to have reminders, you know, some are personal reminders, some are business reminders. So it just depends on your personal needs. But, you know, the bare bones basic, you know, you can use your camera. There's a lot of like QR codes nowadays, for example, because of technology. Instead of business cards, you can just scan the QR code. I have a tap card as well. So you can just use the card, tap it on the phone. It'll bring up links. So things are much, much faster with the use of the phone.
Now, with your tap card, mm-hmm. Explain to our listeners what that is exactly.
So essentially what it is a business card, but there is an RFID chip inside, kind of similar to like your debit or your credit card, how you can wirelessly tap it on a terminal. I can take my link card and I could tap it on a phone and then all of my links will come up, you know, whether it has my bio or my YouTube or my website, whatever it may be. But there's also a QR code on the back of it as well, where, again, you can use your camera and you can scan that QR code and it'll do the same exact thing, bring up that link.
Is there such a thing, now Apple is a smartphone, is there such a thing as non-smartphones? Are the other phones non-smart or are all the phones smartphones?
There's different ways to define that. Because, I mean, if you're looking at that at like base value, like maybe if you ask, you know, your grandkids or something like that, you know, to today's generation, you know, the iPhone 16 and the Samsung Galaxy S24, those are smartphones, right? Because they have like the virtual assistants or different things like that. But, you know, back then, you know, we had like the Nokias and the flip phones and all that. So, I mean, they could still essentially be smartphones because, you know, like even the early Apple phones, there was still camera, there was still you know, the ability to do various other things versus the early phones or beepers where you can just send messages and or make calls.
Are Pixel phones, are they smartphones?
Yes. So Pixel phones, that's actually the Google version of their application of the phones. Just like how Samsung has like the Galaxy and Apple has, of course, their Apple phones, iPhones.
If you're a person that's considering purchasing a phone, mm-hmm. what would you recommend to them in terms of doing the research for Apple versus Pixel versus Samsung? What kind of information would you give them that they should look for when making a decision about what kind of phone to purchase?
So I will go back to what I said before. It all just depends on your industry or depends on what you're trying to do. With Apple phones, they have a very large ecosystem. You know, of course, iPhone, iPad, back then iPods, right? So if you have these other various devices, it would just make sense to stay within that ecosystem. But the trade-off is Apple is very secure, which isn't necessarily a bad thing. But like, for example, with their store, right? They don't have as many apps as like the Google Play Store because they're very strict on what apps they allow, right? They're very strict on customization. Whereas again, with Samsung, you have that full customization. With Samsung, because I have an Android specifically, and I've always had Androids. I've never had an Apple phone myself personally. But for me, like I said, I like the customization. Also, Samsung is very tech savvy. You know, they were the first ones to get rid of the home button on a phone and just have like a full flat screen, right? They were the first ones to get rid of the bezel on the side of the phone. Another thing, the flip phone, like the Galaxy Z Flip. Samsung was the first one to have that type of flip phone where it's not just a regular standard, you know, flip phone from like back in the early 2000s. Now you have phones where you can unfold them and they're like a tablet, right? So it would just all depend on what you're looking for. I can even throw in with Google Pixel. Google Pixel is it's newer compared to Samsung and Apple. But if you're looking for like virtual assistants, you know, Pixel could be really good for that. All the updates come directly from Google. And they even have some cool features, for example, like Magic Eraser, where like let's say you have a picture and you want to get rid of a blemish, or maybe you want to extend the picture, right? You can do that with Google Pixel phones. They have that capability.
Does Apple have that capability? Or all of Pixel's competitors, do they have that capability as well?
They do. I have that in my gallery as well, or like when I take pictures, but it's not as versatile as the Google Pixel version of that. So like with my phone, like if I take a picture, I can get rid of a blemish or something like that, but it's not the same as a Google Pixel, the application of doing it on that phone.
Taking pictures is important to what you want to use your phone for. What category of phone would you suggest people look into?
It all just depends on, it's with like megapixels, right? So a better quality of a photo usually, but I can say, because I've done some of the research, it depends on what kind of photo you're taking as well. And that's the thing, like with all these different phones, they all have so many different features that like there's pros and cons to each one, right? Like for example, with the iPhone takes really well pictures and like at the nighttime, you know. But with the Samsung, during the daytime, it's the most clear, right? It also has the largest zoom. I believe it's like 100 megapixels or something like that, even like 100 telezoom. So, you know, each phone is different depending on what you're trying to do.
How often should you upgrade your phone? How often should you... I mean, does a phone last 3 to 5 years, or does it last longer or shorter?
Like I said, with Apple, when Steve Jobs said, you know, in his early career, you know, hey, this is a utility. That's why Apple has so many users, because, I mean, think about it. Like for example, with cars, right? There might be a family that where they only drive Toyota or they only drive Hyundai because it's versatile for them and it's been in their family for so long. So with Apple, Apple actually is very good on releasing updates for their phones, including older versions of their phones, right? So you might still have, you know, an iPhone, 11 or iPhone X, and you're still getting updates for those. With Android, we get updates as well. But again, because of that customization, it is recommended to update your phone, or to upgrade your phone rather, up to a newer version. Me specifically, I have the Galaxy 20, which is my daughter's phone. I have the Galaxy 21 and I have the 22. Now, obviously, I'm a few years behind as well, because right now the latest Android is the 24. And then I believe the 25 is going to be coming out. It's rumored to come out next year. But for mine, I mean, I'm still comfortable where I'm at. I still get updates as well for all of my phones.
When I go to the App Store to download an app, is the App Store an Apple Store, or is the App Store something that no matter what kind of phone you have, you can go to the App Store and download?
Apple has its own store. It's the Apple Store. And okay. Then Google, well, because again, Google Pixel is the Google phone. So you can access the Google Play Store on your Google Pixel phone. Same thing with Samsung. I use the Google Play Store as well. But Samsung does have a Samsung store. The difference is that that store is specifically for Android apps, which is pretty cool. Just like how Apple has its own Apple apps. But with Google Play Store has the most apps out of all of the out of all three, honestly, about 3 million different apps. Okay. With Apple, it's more secure, again, as I said earlier, for their selection process to add their apps to their store, versus Google, where it's not as secure. It's not that, you know, something would happen or like you're going to get hacked or whatever it may be. It's just, again, it allows for more customization with that store.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Boom Goddess Radio. I'm Jennifer Davis Page, your host. Our guest today is Stephen Somerville with Infinite Broadcasting. Our topic today is smartphones, the difference between iPhones and Androids. Talk to me like I'm in fifth grade. What exactly is an Android phone versus an Apple phone? And are all phones other than Apple Androids? Is that how that works?
So, yes. Like, if we're taking account with the Google Pixel, for example, Google Pixel, that is an Android phone, right? So, with the Apple phones, as we talked about before, there's less customization, right? So, I believe that for the iPhone 16, they just upgraded it where this version of the iPhone allows you to, you know, move your apps around or do various things that the Androids could already do. Essentially, if you would like more customization, like you want to name your folders or you want to change the folder colors, for example, like when you group your apps together or on the homepage is what I'm meaning, like on your phone, you could do that with your Samsung. But with the Apple, it's more restricted, not necessarily in a bad way, but there's just less customization that you can do to the phone itself, right? So if you want like more straight on, like, okay, here's the camera, here's the clock, here's the notes. If you want just more simplicity, then that's where the iPhone would be better for you.
I know it's up to every parent to make a decision as to how old their child should be before they are given any kind of phone. Mm-hmm. Now, I heard you say that your daughter has a phone. How old is she? And why did you make a decision to, how old is she? I guess is my first question.
My daughter's three.
She's three. And you gave her a phone.
Correct.
All right. Why did mm-hmm. you make a decision to give your daughter, your three-year-old daughter, a phone?
So it really all started, originally I had the S20 when it came out. And then when I wanted to upgrade my phones, with my plan that I had at the time, it was better for me to add another line. Okay. Obviously now, of course, I have three lines and I have a watch line as well. But for me, it's more of an accessory for her. Like, it allows, you know, if we're on a road trip or something like that, it allows her to be able to be occupied and have her games on it, right? It's not necessarily for her to, you know, make phone calls or be on the camera. She doesn't quite have access to those apps. But specifically, I know, because again, I'm an Android user, I have what's called kids mode on my phones. Well, on her phone specifically. So with her phone, she only has access to the apps I allow her to have. She can't exit kids mode because it's, of course, it's password restricted. So that's the reason why I have a phone for her, just so that way, you know, if I'm doing something or if she needs to be occupied in that moment and I can't do it, then, you know, she has her phone to play her games.
On the Apple phone, we can put find your friend and we can track each other and find out where we are. Is that something that you have for your daughter on that phone that she has? Do all phones have trackers, I guess is my question.
So yes, they do. For her phone specifically, I have what's called Family Link. I know that that's a feature of Google. I'm not sure, quite sure if it's on Apple. But basically with Family Link, I can essentially, as the head of the household, I can create a family, and then I can add various devices to that Family Link. So now I can monitor, you know, location-wise where my daughter's phone is. I can monitor, you know, how long she's been on YouTube, how long she's been, you know, on her games. I can block games, you know, I can restrict different things. So yes, I do have access to track her and monitor her and make sure she's okay, make sure she's not getting into something she shouldn't be getting into.
So all phones, all phones, smartphones, Androids, Apples, they all have those features. Is that what you're saying?
I don't necessarily know if they all have Family Link. Again, I don't have an Apple phone. But I do believe that if you know, in the maps, like I know for Apple, you know, you can send your location to someone. And I know in Android, you can also send your location to someone. I actually do that with my business phone as well. I just went to the maps and then I'm sharing my location 24/7 from my business phone to my personal phone. You know, maybe I lose my phone or if I leave it somewhere, I can track that as well.
Right. I can do that as well. I mean, I've, you know, sometimes I have find my phone or find my car or find my everything, and it will tell me exactly where it is, which is a wonderful feature. Tell me about rebooting. Do you reboot phones every day, or how often should you reboot your phone, no matter what category you're in?
So usually it's recommended at least once a week. You know, you don't have to necessarily do it every day. And for those who don't know, rebooting your phone or restarting your phone, essentially, that just essentially gets rid of the cache in your phone. Cache, again, for those who don't know, that's like short-term memory, right? So if you're on, you know, various apps and you push the home button to go to the home page, or you go to a different app, all those apps that you have that are being saved, that's cache, right? So when you're restarting your phone, you're getting rid of those hidden cache files that you wouldn't otherwise see. It is recommended to restart the phone because those hidden files can build up over time, and then that's what slows down your phone, similarly to a computer.
When you reboot, is there such a thing as having too many apps on your phone, no matter what kind of phone you had? And if so, how many... I know this is a strange question, but how many apps should you comfortably have on your phone?
Got you. I mean, that's all up to you. I know for my personal phone, I have a lot of games. You know, I'm a gamer, I'm a streamer. So, you know, and my apps that I do have, I mean, they're not small apps. They're bigger, you know, they're like gigabytes. They're not megabytes. It all depends on your type of phone. Right. So each phone, right, each company, they have different storage amounts for your phone. Like mine's a 256. You might have one that might be like a 180 gig. Right. Mm-hmm. So, of course, the more storage you have, the more access you have to having more apps. So for me, comfortably, I probably have about like 50 to 60 apps right now, besides like the basic, you know, like settings or clock. Right. The standard default apps. And my phones, I still have storage space on mine.
Right? And when you're out of storage, your phone alerts you. Is that right? It alerts you that you're out of storage and you can purchase more storage. Is that right?
No, not necessarily. So you can't purchase more storage as in like for apps. You do have what's called the cloud, like you specifically, because you have an iPhone. So you have like iCloud storage, right? So that's more for like your pictures or for your files, right? For me, I have Google Cloud storage or Google Drive as well. So like for me, you know, I have like 5, 6, 7 years of pictures, but it's all in my storage. So I don't have to necessarily keep them in my phone. That allows me to clear up space on my phone for more apps, for more files, etc.
All right. So now I don't know anything about the cloud. I know I've got it, but I don't know what to do with it. Now, does that mean that when you do your pictures automatically go to your cloud? And when it goes to the cloud, does that release space on your phone?
So if you have it set up to go automatically, which most people probably do, then yes, it will automatically sync, right? Okay. That goes real quick. That goes back to the ecosystem of like the Apple products, right? You can see on your iMac or on your iPhone, you can see all of your files and pictures. It doesn't automatically free up space on your phone. You still have to remove the actual photo or file from your phone, but make sure that it's synced to the cloud first. And saved on the cloud, and then you can remove it and download it anytime from the cloud.
I have something on my phone that says PIN, P-I-N. What is that? What does that mean? Do you have that on your phone, and do you know what PIN means?
Are you referring to like for your cloud or for your files?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So that could be where maybe you want to pin a certain file or pin a certain picture to the top, so that way you don't have to scroll and find it, or like a favorite. Because I know I have that on my phone. I have like obviously favorite pictures of me and my daughter, or pictures of my daughter, where I don't have to scroll. I can just go to that folder and it's there.
What features do you feel are most useful? Is that just entirely up to the individual?
I feel like nowadays, definitely camera could be number one, because you know, pictures mean everything. It's not like back then where you had to take a Polaroid picture, and if it was messed up, then you know, you had to either redo it or that was it. So camera, definitely. Space, storage space, I would say that's number two. And then just ease of use, you know. Again, Apple is more straightforward. The Androids are going to have more customization.
So now when we buy our first phone, I'm back to that person that is buying their first phone. You can just go into any of the stores and the salespeople will walk you through once you tell them what you're looking to do. Is that correct?
Correct. I mean, they should be able to. Of course, I don't work specifically for any of those retailers.
I understand. Mm-hmm.
But yeah, they should be able to. You know, if it's not, especially if it's not specified, like there, like how there is an Apple Store. If you go to the Apple Store, then 100% they should be able to help you out with that. But if you go to like T-Mobile, you know, they might not have every single answer for you, but at least they can direct you in the right location.
I only have a time for another question, but what can an iPhone do that an Android? Can they do the same thing, basically?
Essentially, yes. I mean, there might be like slight variations of what, you know, the Apple product can do versus the Android product, but essentially they're all the same.
Now, people that have an iPhone, they've got an iMac computer, or they've got a laptop or whatever. Do all of those other companies have all those same items?
Yes and no. With Google, I believe it's just a phone, just a Google Pixel. But Samsung does have tablets. They do have laptops, as well as, of course, Apple does have that big ecosystem as well.
Terrific. Stephen, we're out of time. I want to thank you so very much for supplying us with this information. I hope it's been helpful to our listeners, and I'm sure it has been. I want to thank our listeners for their continued support. Please join us on BoomGoddessRadio.com. Subscribe to our YouTube channel, Boom Goddess Radio. We can also be heard on Spotify, iHeart, and Amazon. And remember, love, kindness, and respect is never wasted. The only thing that is wasted is a day without a smile. We will see you on the radio next week. This is Jennifer signing off.
Welcome to World Ocean Radio. I'm Peter Neal, director of the World Ocean Observatory. A 2010 demographic study of world religions by the Pew Research Center on Religion and Public Life estimates that there are 5.8 billion religiously affiliated adults and children around the globe, representing 84% of the world population of 6.9 billion. The demographic study, based on analysis of more than 2,500 censuses, surveys, and population registers, finds 2.2 billion Christians, 32% of the world's population, 1.6 billion Muslims, 23%, 1 billion Hindus, 15%, nearly 500 million Buddhists, 7%, and 14 million Jews, 0.2%, around the world as of that year. In addition, more than 400 million people, 6%, practice various folk or traditional religions, including African, Chinese, Native American, and Australian Aboriginal. An estimated 58 million people, slightly less than 1% of the global population, belong to other religions, including the Baha'i faith, Jainism, Sikhism, Shintoism, Taoism, Tenriko, Wicca, and Zoroastrianism. The study also finds that roughly 1 in 6 people around the globe, 1.1 billion or 16%, have no religious affiliation. This makes the unaffiliated the third largest religious group worldwide behind Christians and Muslims, and about equal in size to the world's Catholic population. Surveys indicate that many of the unaffiliated hold some religious or spiritual beliefs, such as belief in God or a universal spirit, even though they do not identify with a particular faith. Let's assume that over the intervening years, these statistics have followed a general percentage increase in parallel to the increase of world population to 8 billion today. It adds up to a complete global community dedicated to some doctrine and moral instruction that influences their values and actions and determines their attitudes and behaviors. But that community seems today in traumatic turmoil, as opposites and apostates, with political agenda, righteous certainty, territorial disputes and conflicts of heart, mind, and hand. If community is defined as fellowship with others, the use of the word seems aspirational at best. And yet, in the context of religious commitment to the ocean and protection of the natural world, here is a selection of some doctrinal statements by leaders of the major religions worldwide that pertain. From the Quran, "Do the unbelievers not see the heavens and the earth were joined together, and we split them apart, and we made from water every living thing?" From Pope Francis's 2015 encyclical, Laudato Si, "Oceans not only contain the bulk of our planet's water supply, but also most of the immense variety of living creatures. When we speak of environment, what we really mean is a relationship existing between nature and the society that lives in it. Nature cannot be regarded as something separate from ourselves or as a mere setting in which we live." And this from the Religious Partnership for the Environment, comprising the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops, the National Council of Churches, the Coalition on Environment and Jewish Life, and the Evangelical Environmental Network. "Through the Jewish and Christian scriptures, water is perhaps the preeminent symbol of life, both spiritual and physical. Abundant, pure water, so necessary for human survival and comfort, manifests divine mercy and healing and occasions gratitude and rejoicing." From the Buddha, "Just as we know the ocean because it always tastes of salt, we can recognize enlightenment because it always tastes of freedom." These statements lie at the core of doctrine and instruction to believers. But what of their practice? What of the commitment to these conjoined principles? What of the values expressed by actions, individual and collective? What of the ever-growing evidence of the failure of that central ethical intention? What of the lost evidence in our indifference to natural systems, shared resources, and undeniable consequence? Is this sin? Original sin? The final pollution of Eden? How, as believers, can we continue to not practice what has been preached, ignoring the teachings, avoiding the confessional, not accepting the responsibility, denying the accountability, and disinterest in the reparation or restoration or renewal? By abandoning the natural world, do we also abandon God? As Muslims, Catholics, Protestants, Jews, Buddhists, fundamentalists, and other religious agnostics and atheists, perhaps it's time to ask again these questions. There are answers, if we're prepared to embrace them. We will discuss these issues and more in future editions of World Ocean Radio.
tuned in to listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
Bienvenidos a un breve informativo en su estación comunitaria KBOO 90.7 FM. Hoy jueves 19 de diciembre del 2024. Unas